Never take anything I say or do at face value, Sirsin. It was never about that. You needed to break some of your ridiculous rules. I merely put you in a position where you would be forced to question them. Had you truly killed her, I would have been vastly disappointed. You never understood what I was really after. Sirsin shook his head, muttering beneath his breath. All his angst about breaking the vow had been for naught, because Adam had never wished it fulfilled to begin with. And I do not understand now, so why not explain it to me? Adam circled around him, studying him. Why don't you put down that sword? He shuddered. We gave it to you so we wouldn't be tempted to fight among our own kind. We trusted you. You coerced me into the guardianship, and well you know it, he said bitterly. Still, he let the tip dip toward the floor, although he kept his hand firmly on the hilt. Adam relaxed. The way I see it, you have several choices. You can go join her where she is, in my world, he added smugly. Or you may bring her back here. Or you may go fix her future and then send her back. She is safely out of time while you decide. Why do you mock me, Adam? You know I do not know how to accomplish any of those things. Are you offering to perform such magic for me? Adam looked pained. I cannot. Evil has clipped my wings, so to speak. Then exactly how do you expect me to dart about through time? Morar is not accessible by mortal means. You have trapped my woman on a fairy isle to which I have no means of traveling, he said, growing angry again. Adam eyed Sirsin challengingly. Yes, you do. Sirsin flung a hand up in the air. I cannot sift time. If I could, I would have offered to return her when I discovered what she'd lost, and how much it pained her. You can sift time. You know that. You know also that there was a time recently when you would have given anything to have long ago accepted my lessons. You refuse to let me teach you, but you know you have the power. It seethes within you. It begs to be freed. You would learn quickly. It would take me mere days to teach you how to sift time. We can practice with short jaunts. Sirsin regarded him, saying nothing. A muscle in his jaw twitched. Sirsin, I have been telling you for 500 years that I can teach you how to move through time and place. You have always sneered and walked away. Now I offer again. I can teach you how to sift time, weave worlds, how to change her future so her parents don't die. I can teach you enough that you can prevent the car wreck, perhaps even prevent the cancer, and return her to her future with her memory of you intact. When it is done, you may join her there, or bring her back, or split your lives between the two places. You can do anything you want, Sirsin Brody. I've always told you this. And what price for such knowledge, Adam? What price for my woman back? Oh, it's so simple, Adam said gently. It's all I have ever wanted, all along. He nodded encouragingly. You know what I want? I offer you a trade. Let me teach you. Let me take you where you belong. Let me show you my world. It is not evil. Sirsin grunted and rubbed his eyes. 500 years ago he'd sworn to avoid this moment at all costs. Throughout the centuries, Adam had tempted him repeatedly with anything he could think of, and failed each time. Apparently, Adam had realized that the trap would have to be more cunningly laid, and this one had succeeded brilliantly. That which Sirsin had refused for 5 centuries had now become inevitable. The 9th-century man within him shrugged, stepped down, and ceded defeat. Was it evil? Were Adam and his race evil? Or had Sersin simply never forgiven Adam for slights inflicted long ago? His choices were painfully simple. Be with Lisa, or not be with Lisa. The latter was unacceptable, and Adam knew that. Sersin felt bitterly manipulated by Adam, and anger burned within him. This situation had been designed and orchestrated by Adam Black from the onset. But then he thought of Lisa. What existed between them had nothing to do with Adam. Adam may have cleverly manipulated events, but Sersin alone had fallen in love with Lisa. He would have loved her no matter where he'd found her. His anger melted away. If he accepted what Adam was offering, he could change her life. He could slip to the future and save her parents and return to her everything she'd ever wanted and be with her again. And hadn't he been toying with that idea for some time now? When he'd asked her to tell him everything about her life, when he'd listened and taken mental notes, aye, even then he'd been analyzing possibilities in the back of his mind. His bitterness over Adam's making him immortal 500 years past had caused him to violently reject everything about the Tuatha De Danann. But perhaps it wouldn't be so bad after all. He knew she loved him. Since he had to accept Adam's lessons, if only to rescue her from the Fairy Isle, why not go all the way? Why not perfect her world and give her all her heart's desires? What a gift, to be so powerful that he could ensure her wildest dreams! What else might he be able to give her?
Everything,
Adam said wordlessly. Sersin glanced at Adam. Dare he brave her time? Dare he go forward and love her there? He would love her anywhere. Dare he give Adam what he wanted? Sersin Brody drew a deep breath and regarded the blackest elf. He saw before him the potential for corruption, unlimited power, terrifying freedom. Perhaps he saw a bit of himself in those dark eyes. It's so easy, Adam assured him. It won't hurt a bit. Once you've said it, for the first time, you'll find it feels quite natural after a while. Sersin nodded.
Then teach me. Teach me everything you know, Father.
Soaring. So sweet a kiss, Yestrin Frey, thee I reft, in bowing doon thy body on the bed, that even my life within thy lips I left. Since then, from thee my spirit's walt never shed. To his mistress, Alexander Montgomery. Chapter 29.
Do not think this means I forgive you for seducing my mother,
Sersin said later.
I didn't ask you to,
Adam said with a chiding, paternal expression that made Sersin uncomfortable.
She was irresistible, you know. Rarely has one of our kind successfully bred with a mortal, and had the child survive to maturity. But you Brudes have such life force that it was possible, as I'd suspected when I seduced her.
You destroyed my father. His own jealousy destroyed him. I did not raise a hand against him, and that man had nothing to do with siring you.
You are my son, and mine only. No seed of his made you. When Morgana died, I refused to lose you, too.
So you made me immortal. I hated you for that.
I know that.
The two men were silent for a time.
Is it truly possible to alter her future and return her to a better one?
Sersin asked. Yes. We will go to her future and change it twice. Actually, he amended, we will likely need many trips to her time to get it right. Then we will go to Morar, and we will send her on to the new future.
But won't she have lived portions of it twice?
She will have the equivalent of 5 years of dual memory. Will it damage her mind?
Lisa? Need you ask that? The woman is nearly Brood.
Sirson felt a flash of pride.
Aye, that she is.
He was silent for a moment.
But I do not understand how to do it. Patience. You've been a quick study on your own, you know.
I've watched you.
I know you use heightened speed. I know you scry. I know you've altered space around you without even being aware of it.
We will proceed slowly.
Slowly is good, Sirson said. My head pounds with too many strange concepts.
We will move at a snail's pace, Adam assured him. There is much to be learned about our kind, Sirson, but you must learn it in stages. The madness doesn't result from immortality. It is an annoying and temporary side effect of our far vision. We see how everything interconnects, and if you seek that knowledge too quickly, it can make you lose perspective, even cause madness.
Someday, I will be able to see those things too?
Yes. I learned too quickly, arrogantly certain that nothing could ever harm me. When the understanding came, it overwhelmed me just as Evil had warned it would. But I will bring you to the knowledge of our race slowly enough that you can absorb it while learning it.
Adam, the spear? Sirson said hesitantly.
What of it?
Adam replied, a hint of amusement curving his lip. The spear and the sword are the only weapons that can kill immortals. The spear was used to wound Christ.
You're beginning to see connections. Keep looking.
But what?
You will find your own way. These are things that must come slowly. You cannot expect to overthrow too quickly everything you thought was true. You are still a ninth-century man in many ways. There will be plenty of time to talk of these things later. For now, let us concentrate on Lisa, and you discovering who and what you are. This is all I ever wanted from the beginning, Sirson. For you to accept that I am your father, and be willing to learn about your heritage. I am the only Tuatha De Danann who has a full-grown son, he added smugly. Some of them resent me for it.
Sirson rolled his eyes, and Adam, caught up in adoring himself, ignored it.
I can teach you to sift time, but a fuller understanding of your abilities will not come for many years. Are you certain you wish to proceed?
I will not have you later cry foul and be angry with me again. 500 years of your bad temper is all I can stand.
I am certain.
Teach me.
Come.
Adam extended his hand. Let us begin and regain your mate. Welcome to my world, son.
Sirson's instruction at Adam's hands commenced the next morning, and the Laird of Brody began slowly to understand what he'd always sensed within him, and feared, the potential for unlimited power. He began to see why it had frightened him. He, a warrior who feared nothing. Such power was terrifying because the ability to use it carried immense responsibilities. What had once seemed a vast, unexplored wilderness, his country, Scotland, was now put into astonishing perspective. There were other worlds, far beyond the one they inhabited. He realized why the Tuatha De Danann seemed detached to mortals. The tiny bit of land called Scotland and their tiny war for independence was one of millions in the universe. Over the next few days of learning just a tiny bit about himself, he began to develop, loath though he was to admit it, some respect for the man who had sired him. Adam was indeed given to strange amusements, prone to meddle and to be prankish. However, considering the extent of what his blackest elf could actually do, Sirson realized that Adam generally exercised admirable restraint. He also began to realize how mortals, who had no such magic, could so gravely misunderstand those who wielded it. He eyed his father, who was bent over an ancient tome from which he'd been reading aloud, giving Sirson more background on his race. It was difficult to conceive of the exotic man as his father, for Adam wore his customary glamour that made him seem even younger than Sirson.
"Adam, what of this bond I have with her? What happened that night when she and I
made love?
Ah, tupped, as Duncan would say."
Adam raised his head from the book.
"What did Morgana tell you when you were a lad?"
"About what? She told me many things."
Sirson shrugged.
"What did she tell you about spilling your seed in a woman?"
Adam asked, trying not to laugh.
"Oh, that. She told me it would fall off,"
Sirson muttered darkly. Adam tossed back his head, shaking with mirth.
"That is exactly something Morgana would have said. She knew better than to reason with the stubborn boy you were. And did you ever spill in a woman?"
"Nay. At first I believed her and feared it would indeed fall off. Then, when I was old enough to realize she'd been jesting with me, I didn't, because I didn't wish to scatter my bastards across the land. Finally, when I wed Naya and was ready to have a family, I discovered what you had done.
I told you the same day, didn't I? I knew you would plan children."
"You told me to prevent me?"
Sirson said, startled.
"Of course. I knew what would happen if you did. You would have been bound to a woman you did not love, and that is the purest hell for us."
"So spilling my seed in a woman links us.
It seems to be a side effect of our immortality. Our life force is so strong, so potent, that when we find our release inside a mortal woman, the union that is forged connects us. And that link will soon include your child."
"Lisa's not pregnant,"
Sirson said quickly. Adam glanced at him mockingly.
"Of course she is. You, half fey and half mortal, are much more virile than we are. You might be our hope for the future."
"Lisa is carrying my child?"
Sirson roared.
"Yes. From the moment you spent your seed, the first time you made love to her."
Sirson was struck silent.
"The first 7 months are splendid. It's amazing when the child's force starts to mingle with yours and hers. You feel the babe's awakening, its excitement and burgeoning life. You marvel at what you have created. You hunger to see it arrive. Then the last 2 months become hellish. You, Sirson, were a pain in the ass. You wanted out. You kicked and brooded and argued, and suddenly I developed cravings for ridiculous foods I'd never wanted before. And, oh, the birth! Sweet Dagda, I suffered her labor. I felt the pain, and I felt the creation, the wonder. By the time you birth your first child, you and Lisa will be so deeply bound you won't be able to imagine breathing without her."
Sirson was silent, awed by the thought of Lisa's pregnancy and what was to come. Then the enormity of what Adam had just admitted struck him.
"You had such a bond with my mother?"
"I am not without emotion, Sirson," Adam replied stiffly. "I endeavor to keep it still."
"But she died."
"Yes," Adam said.
"And I ran to the farthest ends of the earth, trying not to feel her death. But I couldn't escape it. Even on Morar, even on other worlds, I felt her dying.
Why did you let her?
Adam gave him a black look.
At least now that you understand that what I had with Morgana is what you have with Lisa, imagine what I endured permitting her to die. Perhaps you can find it within you to be less harsh in your judgment of me.
But why did you let her?
Sirson repeated. Adam shook his head. My life with Morgana is another story, and we have no time for it now. Sirson studied the exotic man, who would no longer meet his gaze. Permit Lisa to die? Never.
But you could have made her immortal, he pressed, with a sense of desperation.
Adam's jaw was rigid. He shot Sirson a furious gaze.
She wouldn't accept it. Now leave it!
Sirson closed his eyes. Why had his mother refused the potion if Adam had offered it? Would Lisa refuse? He would not allow her to do so, he resolved. Never would he permit her to die. Gone were the vague feelings of guilt for his thoughts of making her immortal. After what Adam had just told him, he knew he could never endure losing the union they shared.
A child.
She carried his babe, and the bond would swell to include their son or daughter. Live through Lisa's death? No. But in recompense for taking her mortality, he would give her the perfect future with her family. It would be his way of making amends. Sirson materialized at dawn on the day of her graduation. Swiftly, he scaled the wall surrounding the stone estate. Swiftly, he punctured the wheels on the small machine to prevent it from moving. Then he regarded the bigger machine irritably. Which one is a Mercedes? He wondered with a scowl. Moving quickly, he punctured those wheels too. But what if they changed the wheels? What if they had new wheels somewhere in their keep? He glared at the keep. Then he glowered at the machines for a long moment, holding them personally responsible for hurting his woman. He struggled against an intense desire to creep into the home and peer down at the sleeping 18-year-old Lisa he hadn't yet met.
"Stay away from her. You are so dense sometimes, Sirson,"
Adam's bodiless voice mocked.
"You still don't understand the power you have. Why are you trying to harm the machines when you can simply make them go away? For that matter, why did you appear outside the gate and climb the wall, when you might have appeared within the gates?"
Sirson frowned.
"I am unaccustomed to this power. And where would I send them?"
"Send them to Morar. That should be interesting."
Adam laughed. Sirson shrugged and focused his newfound center of power. He closed his eyes and visualized the silica sands of Morar. With a small nudge, the machines disappeared. If they landed on the Isle of Morar with a soft whoosh of white silica sand, only one mortal was there to see it, and she hadn't been surprised by anything in quite some time.
"Our cars have been stolen!" Catherine exclaimed.
Jack peered over his newspaper.
"Did you look for them?"
he asked absently, as if a Mercedes and a Jeep could be overlooked.
"Well, of course I did, Jack," Catherine said. "How are we going to get to Lisa's graduation? We can't miss her big day."
Sirson tugged the cap low on Adam's forehead, stepped back, and grinned.
"Perfect.
I don't see why I have to do this. I do not wish to risk being seen, nor dare I trust myself to see her. I do not know that I could restrain myself, so you must do it."
"This uniform is ridiculous."
Adam tugged at the crotch.
"It's too small."
"Then make it bigger, oh powerful one," Sirson said dryly. "Quit procrastinating and call their number. Tell them the cab is on the way."
"But they didn't call for one."
"I'm counting on whoever answers to think someone else must have."
Adam arched a brow.
"You're good at this."
"Call."
Sure enough, Catherine assumed that Jack had called and ordered a cab to arrive at precisely 9 a.m. When it appeared, Jack assumed that Catherine had called. In the fuss over filing stolen car reports with the police and the insurance company, neither thought to ask the other.
"What's next?" Adam asked, rubbing his hands.
Sirson shot him a dark look.
"You seem to be enjoying this."
Adam shrugged.
"I have never before manipulated in such fine detail. It's quite fascinating."
"Cancer. She said her mother was dying of cancer," Sirson said. "We don't even know what kind. I suspect this is not going to be as simple as making two machines disappear. We must find a way to prevent her from catching this disease. And from what I've read, they don't seem to know what causes it. I've been flipping through these books all night."
He gestured to the medical books scattered across his desk in the study at Castle Brody. Adam picked up several and scanned them. The Cincinnati Public Library was stamped on the spine.
"You pilfered from the library?" Adam said with mock dismay.
"I had to. I tried to borrow them, but they wanted papers I didn't have. So I went back when they were closed, and a security guard. They protect their books even in the future. Nearly attacked me before I'd finished finding what I wanted." He sighed. "But I'm no closer to discovering how to prevent the disease. I must know what type of cancer she had."
Adam thought for a moment.
"Are you up to some more nocturnal raiding? I believe there are no more than a half dozen hospitals in her city."
"Hospitals?"
Sirson's brow furrowed.
"You really are a medieval brute. Hospitals are where they treat the ill. We will go to her time and steal her records. Come, sift time and I will be your faithful guide."
"She has cervical cancer,"
Sirson said softly, glancing over his shoulder at Adam, who was reclining on the desk in a private office at Good Samaritan Hospital.
"Listen to this. The diagnosis was severe dysplasia. Over time, it became advanced invasive cancer. They refer to something called cervical intraepithelial neoplasia."
His tongue felt thick over the strange words, and he pronounced them very slowly.
"The notes indicate Catherine might have been diagnosed in time to prevent the cancer, had she had something called a pap test. The notes indicate that Catherine told the doctor her last pap test was 8 years before they diagnosed the cancer. It seems cervical cancer is caused by a type of virus that is easily treated in the early stages."
Adam fanned rapidly through the textbook he had plucked off the desk. Locating an applicable entry, he read aloud,
"Pap screening test. A cancer screening test developed in 1943 by Dr. George Papanicolaou. The Pap test examines cells from the cervix, or the mouth of the womb, located at the top of the vagina."
Adam was silent for a long moment.
"It says a woman should have a pap test annually. Why didn't she?"
Sirson shrugged. "I don't know. But it sounds as if we go back a few years, we should be able to prevent it."
Adam marched a brow.
"How can we fix this?
Just how do you intend to get a woman who obviously hates to go to the doctor to go see the doctor?"
Sirson grinned. "A little gentle persuasion."
Catherine thumbed through the mail, hunting for a letter from her friend Sarah, who was in England for the summer. She tossed aside two flyers, snorting indelicately. Recently, she'd been receiving a rash of junk mail dealing with one thing, gynecologists and cervical cancer.
"Have you had your pap smear this year?" one banner screamed.
"Cervical cancer is preventable," a bright pink flyer exclaimed.
They were all from a non-profit organization she'd never heard of. Apparently some do-gooder who had money to burn. She tossed them in the wastebasket and resumed flipping through the mail. But something nagged at her, so she retrieved the last flyer. She must have received 50 of those things over the past month, and each time she threw one away,
she felt a peculiar sense of déjà vu. She'd even received a call from a doctor's office this week, offering a free exam. She had never heard of any doctor offering free pap tests before.
When was my last checkup?
She wondered, fingering the flyer. At nearly 16, Lisa was ready to start having annual checkups. It might be a bit difficult to persuade her daughter to have her first visit when Catherine wasn't faithful about making and keeping her own appointments. She regarded the pamphlet thoughtfully. It said that cancer of the cervix was preventable, that a routine pap smear could detect many abnormalities, and that women in all age groups were at risk. Decisively, she plunked down the pamphlet and called her gynecologist to schedule appointments for herself and Lisa. Sometimes she and Jack tended to be irresponsible about things like checkups and life insurance and servicing the cars. She'd not seen her gynecologist because she felt perfectly fine. But that was like saying the car didn't need service because it was running perfectly fine. Maintenance was different from repairs. Preventive medicine can save your life, the pamphlet said. Life was good, and Catherine certainly didn't want to miss one moment of Lisa's growing up. She had grandchildren to look forward to one day. Perhaps she should have Jack look into some life insurance while she was at it. Chapter 30.
You are certain this will work?
Sirson worried.
Yes, we will remove her from Morar while she sleeps, and return her to a new future.
I've done this before. However, this is the only time I have allowed the person to retain dual memories.
Are you certain you wish her to recall the other reality? The one where her father died and her mother is ill?
Yes. If we take it from her, she will not know me. She will have no memory of our time together. Without those memories, she would be a different person, and I love her precisely the way she is.
Then let's do it, Adam said. She will be very confused at first. You will need to get to her quickly to help her understand. Once she has been returned, race to her side. She'll need you.
Lisa was drifting when she heard the voices.
You must do it now, Sirson.
Sirson, my love.
Her dreaming mind purred.
I'm coming, Lisa.
Lisa woke from a sleep that felt drugged. Her pillow smelled funny. She sniffed it. Jasmine and sandalwood. The scent brought tears to her eyes. It reminded her of Sirson, the way the faint smell had always seemed part of his skin. Another scent overpowered it swiftly. Frying bacon. She kept her eyes closed and puzzled over that thought. Where was she? Had she stumbled down the beach and in her delirium found a house and a bed? She opened her eyes cautiously. She looked about the room, seeking traces of the 14th century. Her first thought was that she'd blessedly traveled back to Sirson. But as her gaze skimmed again over the pale blue walls, her heart thudded painfully. She recognized this room, and had thought to never see it again. She dropped her disbelieving gaze to the bed in which she lay, a four-poster of blonde wood with a frothy white canopy. She'd adored this bed in their home in Indian Hill, a lifetime ago. She shot straight up in bed, trembling violently. Had she finally, irrevocably lost her mind?
Mom?
She called, knowing full well no one was going to answer her. And because no one would answer her, she felt safe tossing her head back and wailing it.
Mom!
She heard the rush of feet on the stairs, and held her breath as the door opened. It seemed to inch inward in slow motion, as if she were watching a movie, and the door opened frame by frame. Her heart tightened painfully when Catherine stepped in, a spatula in her hand, her brows drawn together in an expression of concern.
What is it, Lisa? Did you have a bad dream, darling?
Lisa swallowed, unable to speak.
Her mother looked precisely as she would have looked had the car accident never happened, had the cancer never taken her. Eyes wide, she feasted on the impossible vision.
"Mom?"
she croaked. Catherine looked at her expectantly.
"Is, Daddy here?"
Lisa asked faintly, struggling to comprehend this new reality.
"Of course not, sleepyhead. You know he leaves for work at 7. Are you hungry?"
Lisa stared. "Of course not, sleepyhead. So normal, so routine, as if Catherine and Lisa had never been separated. As if Daddy had always been alive, and the tragic past that had torn their family apart had never happened."
"What year is it?"
she managed. Her mother laughed.
"Lisa!"
She reached out a hand and tousled her hair.
"It must have been quite a dream."
Lisa narrowed her eyes, thinking hard. Downstairs, the doorbell chimed, and Catherine turned toward the sound.
"Who could that be this early?"
She glanced back at Lisa.
"Come down for breakfast, darling. I made your favorite. Poached eggs, bacon, and toast."
Lisa watched her mom leave the room, stunned. She fought the urge to leap from her bed, wrap her arms around her mother's departing knees, and hang on for dear life. Her mother's knees were unscarred and strong. Joy flooded her. She must have died, she decided, on that strange beach in the stranger land. Was this heaven? She'd take it, whatever it was. Snatches of conversation floated up from the foyer. She tuned them out, studying her room. She'd kept a calendar on her desk and was itching to know when she was now. But before she could move, her mother called up.
"Lisa, darling, come down. You have a guest. He says he's a friend of yours from the university."
Her mother's voice sounded excited and oh so approving. University? She was in college? Oh, this was heaven. Now all she needed was Cersen to make it complete. Lisa leaped from the bed, tugged on her favorite white fluffy robe, astonishing that it was hanging right on her bedpost where she'd always hung it, and hurried down the stairs, wondering who could possibly be calling for her. As she rounded the curved staircase, her heart thumped hard in her chest. Cersen Brody arched a brow and smiled. Simultaneously, a wave of love hit her, sent along their special bond. Lisa nearly whimpered, overwhelmed with pleasure, disbelief, and confusion. He was wearing charcoal trousers and a black silk polo shirt that rippled across his muscular chest, from which he was dusting a light misting of rain. His hair had been trimmed and was pulled back in a leather thong. Expensive Italian boots made her blink and shake her head. She'd never seen him in such fitted clothing, and could only imagine the stir he must have caused, strolling around in the 21st century. Clothing didn't make this man. He made the clothing, molding it with his powerful body. 6 feet 7 inches of rippling brawn. She briefly envisioned him in a pair of faded jeans, and nearly swooned.
"Mrs. Stone, would you mind terribly if I took your daughter out to breakfast? We have some catching up to do."
Catherine eyed the magnificent man standing in the doorway.
"No, not at all. Why don't you just come in and have some coffee while Lisa gets dressed?"
she invited graciously.
"Wear jeans, lass,"
Cersen said, his gaze intense.
"And your... you knows,"
he added in a voice roughened by desire. Catherine glanced back and forth between them, taking in the tender, passionate look from the tall, elegant man in the doorway, and the startled, yet dreamy expression on Lisa's face. She wondered why Lisa had hidden the fact that she was in love, and from her own mother at that. Not once had Lisa mentioned a boyfriend, but Catherine decided that perhaps she hadn't spoken of it because it was the real thing. When Catherine had first met Jack, she'd told no one about him. She'd felt that talking about it might somehow debase the private sanctity of their bond.
Lisa still hadn't moved from the base of the steps. She couldn't breathe. She was riveted by him. How had this come to pass? How was Sirson Brody standing in the doorway of her Indian Hill home, talking to her living, healthy mother, while her living, healthy father was at work, when she'd left him 700 years in the past? The dream flooded back over her.
We must do it now.
What did you do?
She asked weakly.
What did he do about what, Lisa?
Catherine asked curiously.
We have much to discuss, lass, he said tenderly.
Is that a brogue I detect?
Catherine exclaimed.
I've always thought Scotland was such a romantic country. Jack and I have been discussing going for summer vacation this year.
Sirson moved to Catherine, raised her hand to his lips, and brushed her knuckles with a kiss.
Perhaps you could visit my home when you come, he said. I would be pleased to welcome Lisa's parents into my keep.
Lisa had never seen Catherine so flustered.
Keep! She exclaimed. Don't tell me you have a castle! Oh, I'll just get that coffee, she said with a breathless laugh.
As she turned toward the kitchen, she glanced back at her daughter, who was still standing frozen at the foot of the stairs.
Lisa, did you hear him? He wants to take you to breakfast. Although the way he's dressed, I'm not certain jeans would be appropriate, darling. Perhaps the beige dress with those strappy sandals I like so much.
Lisa nodded stupidly, just to get her mother out of the room. Then she realized that she was encouraging her healthy mother to leave the room. She flung a startled look at Sirson and mouthed,
Just a minute. Don't move.
Then flew across the foyer, catching up with her mother as she entered the hall.
Wait!
She cried. Catherine turned around and looked at her quizzically.
You're acting very odd today, Lisa.
She smiled, leaned near to Lisa's ear and whispered,
I like him. Oh, my! Why didn't you tell me about him?
Lisa threw her arms around Catherine.
I love you, Mom,
she said fiercely. Catherine gave a startled and pleased little laugh, just the kind of half-breathless sound of joy Lisa remembered from before Jack had died, in the other reality.
I don't know what this is all about, Lisa, but I love you too, darling. Only tell me your next words aren't going to be, and I'm sorry, but I'm pregnant and running off to get married,
she teased.
I'm not ready for an empty nest.
Lisa's hand flew to her abdomen, and her eyes widened.
Oh, I should get dressed.
Leaving her mother with raised brows and a very intrigued expression on her face, Lisa fled the hallway before she could think much harder about the possibility her mother had raised. Chapter 31 Lisa glanced around the suite, bewildered. After she had slipped on lacy Unos, jeans and a blouse, Sirson had efficiently navigated traffic and driven them downtown to the Cincinnatian, where he'd reserved a suite. She was stunned by how capable he was, how quickly he'd adapted to and taken control of her modern-day world. But then she remembered that the man was a born conqueror and warrior, and the 21st century, while overwhelming, was just one more challenge for him, and he would master it with the same aplomb as he'd mastered his own century. He'd explained a bit on the ride there, and gravely informed her that he forgave her for leaving him, although his lower lip had been set at such an angle that she'd known his feelings had been hurt. He'd also explained that they'd kept her on the Isle of Morar, while he and Adam had changed her future, and filled her in on how they'd prevented the car wreck and the cancer.
But I thought you hated Adam.
Sirson sighed as he popped open a bottle of champagne and poured two glasses. Dropping onto the bed, he gave her a guilty look and patted the bed beside him. He opened his arms.
Come. I need you, lass, he whispered before closing his mouth over hers. Then he proceeded to show her how very much he needed her.
Clothing fell swiftly away as they undressed each other urgently. When she was clad in nothing but a lacy pale pink bra and panties, he lifted her high in his arms above him and fell back onto the bed. Lisa sat astride him and ran her hands over his muscled chest, following the trail of silky dark hair with a feather-light finger. Slipping the strap of her bra down, he groaned softly.
"I love these lacy things."
Lisa laughed and dropped her head forward so that her hair curtained his face.
"I love you."
"I know,"
he said smugly, and for a few moments she was lost in a wave of passion and tenderness and love that surged silently along their unique bond.
"Never leave me, lass. You are the one and only, forever."
"What?"
she exclaimed.
"Did you hear me?"
With lazy sensuality, he dragged his tongue over the peak of her nipple through the thin silk of her bra. It crested eagerly.
"Words! I heard you in words!"
"Mmm,"
he murmured, nipping gently at the buds he'd teased beneath the silk. With a quick snap, her bra was off, and he cupped her breasts in his hands, brushing the pads of his thumbs over her nipples.
"Will you love me forever?"
He caught a nipple between his thumb and forefinger, tugging gently. Lisa shook her head, trying to clear it. Even after all the time she'd made love with him, she still couldn't think clearly when he was touching her.
"What are you saying?"
"That I need you forever, Lisa Brody. Wed me, and have babies with me, and give me forever."
"Lisa Brody?"
she squeaked.
"You do not think I'd leave you in shame, do you? Be my wife. I promise you will want for naught."
He slipped his hands inside her panties and cupped her bottom. His gaze was fixed on her abdomen, as if he were trying to see inside her. Her hand flew to her stomach.
"Do you know something I don't know?"
she asked suspiciously.
"Just that you've already done one of the three things I am asking you to do."
"I'm pregnant? I'm going to have your baby?"
she exclaimed, a shiver of delight racing up her spine.
"Our baby. Yes, lass, he already grows within you, and he will be very special. Marry me, love."
"Yes,"
she said.
"Oh, yes, 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 Sirson."
"I am the luckiest man in the world."
"Yes,"
Lisa agreed, then thought no more for a long time. Afterward, they showered together, slipping and sliding in the huge marble shower that had six spouts, three on each wall. Sirson indulged with the unfettered pleasure of a 14th-century barbarian who'd never seen a shower before, standing in the streams of the water, shaking his head and spraying it everywhere. They made love on the marble floor, in the corner against the wall, and in the jacuzzi. Lisa, wrapped in a fluffy white robe, was toweling her hair dry when she heard Sirson yelling in the bedroom. Startled, she slipped from the bathroom only to discover Sirson standing nude in front of the TV, roaring at it.
"William Wallace did not look like that!"
he gestured irritably at the TV. Lisa laughed as she realized he was pointing at a blue-faced Mel Gibson, storming into battle in Braveheart.
"And Robert do not look like that!"
he complained.
"Perhaps you should try writing a script yourself,"
she teased.
"They'd never believe it. It is obvious your time has no idea what my time was really like."
"Speaking of your time and my time, where, or should I say when, will we live, Sirson?"
Sirson pressed the off button on the remote control like a pro and turned to her.
"Any place you wish, Lisa. We can spend 6 months in my time and 6 months here, or go week to week. I know you wish to be near your family. We could take them back, too."
Lisa's eyes grew wide.
"We could?" We could take my mom and dad to your time.
How would you like to be married in a 14th century ceremony, with your mother and father in attendance? Your father may bequeath you to me, and I, in turn, will grant him a handsome manor, should your parents choose to retire there. Of course, Robert, Duncan, and Galen will insist upon being present as well. I'm afraid it may turn into quite a spectacle. Lisa couldn't stop smiling.
I would love that! A fairy tale wedding!
Provided we are cautious not to change too many things, I see no problem arranging it. I'm beginning to understand what Adam meant when he said if one looks down the timeline, one can discern which things are irrevocable and should not be manipulated, and which things will make little difference.
Adam,
Lisa said hesitantly. She hadn't forgotten for a moment that Cersen hadn't answered her earlier question.
Yes,
a voice said behind her, as Adam materialized in their suite. He grinned at Cersen.
So you finally got around to asking her to marry you. I was beginning to despair. Every time I tried to pop in, the two of you were...
She spun around.
You!
Adam grinned puckishly, turned into Aaron, then turned back into Adam. Lisa was speechless, but only for a moment. She advanced on him.
You saw me in my bath!
What? Cersen thundered.
He visited me the whole time I was in your century,
she clarified. Cersen glared at his father.
Did you?
Adam shrugged, the cameo of innocence.
I was concerned you might not be treating her well enough, and checked in from time to time.
You should be grateful that I decided upon full disclosure. I had considered just telling her that Aaron had run off when she got around to asking about him, but I've decided to try to be a new person henceforth, at least around you and Lisa.
Why do you put up with him?
Lisa said, shaking her head.
Lisa, it's all right,
Cersen said, moving swiftly to her side. It's not what you think. He scowled at Adam.
Do not think I've forgotten you saw her in her bath. We will speak of it later, the three of us, and have the whole story out. But how did you come here by yourself? Has Evil forgiven you?
Adam preened, casting his silky dark hair over his shoulder.
Of course, I am once again all-powerful. Why are you being nice to him?
Lisa snapped.
Lass, he helped me do all that I've done.
He made you immortal.
And if he hadn't, I never would have met you, but would have died over 1,000 years before you were born. He helped save your mother and father, and Adam is my father.
Your father?
She gaped for a moment as the information sank in. Heavens, but there was obviously a great deal she still didn't know about Cersen Brody. But she was more than willing to learn. Cersen guided her to a chair and sat her down. Then the two men took turns filling in her gaps of knowledge regarding the man who would be her husband. And once she knew, it made perfect sense and explained everything. His unusual powers, his resentment toward Adam, Adam's unwillingness to let his son die. A few moments of silence passed while she pondered all they'd told her. Then she realized they were both watching her intently, and it seemed that they were waiting for something. Adam moved to her side and reached in his pocket, and Lisa watched curiously, wondering what new thing they were going to spring on her next.
You know now that I am half fairy, Lisa, Cersen said gently. Can you accept that?
Lisa stood on her tiptoes and kissed him full on the lips.
Yes,
she assured him.
No regrets.
No regrets.
When Adam withdrew a shimmering flask and a pair of goblets, and poured 3 drops of glowing liquid into one of the glasses, Lisa scarcely breathed. She watched in silence as Adam passed the glasses of champagne to Cersen, who, with great deliberation,
offered Lisa the glass with the potion in it. He regarded her gravely, then gave her a tender smile.
Love me forever, lass.
Lisa looked deep into his eyes.
Live with me forever. Cease my endless solitude. I will cherish you. I will show you worlds you've only dreamed of. I will walk beside you, hand in hand, until the end of days.
Lisa reached for the goblet. Champagne had never tasted sweeter. Author's note. Catherine Stone's cervical cancer was indeed preventable. While doing research for the Highlander's Touch, I was distressed to discover the number of women who die from this disease each year. Cervical cancer is killing some 200,000 women annually, and at least 370,000 new cases are identified each year. It has been estimated that only 5% of women in developing countries have been screened for cervical dysplasia in the past 5 years, and only 40 to 50% in developed countries. A simple Pap screening test performed by a gynecologist can detect cervical dysplasia in its precancerous stages. The earlier it is detected, the less invasive the treatment. An annual Pap screening test changed Catherine's life and could change the lives of many others. We women need to take care of ourselves. If you'd like to learn more about the Knights Templar, I suggest The History of the Knights Templar by Charles G. Addison, Adventures Unlimited Press, or The Trial of the Templars by Malcolm Barber, Cambridge University Press. For an interesting look at the mythology surrounding the Order, I recommend The Holy Grail by Norma Lore Goodrich, HarperCollins. I tried to detail the history of the Order as accurately as possible in the face of myriad conflicting sources. My research uncovered as many references to the Templars' involvement in the battle at Bannockburn as sources that deny their involvement. However, the Scottish Order of the Knights Templar, associated with the area around Roslyn Chapel, is still in existence today. The last I heard from Lisa, she had just graduated from a local university and was preparing to go on to medical school. She was adamant I mentioned that she finally got to go to college. And Sirson? After having lived for so many centuries, he is not quite as driven by a thirst for knowledge as Lisa, and instead devotes his days and nights to pleasing his woman. Oh, and I nearly forgot. Adam insists I mention him. If you'd like to know more about him, I keep reminding him he is not the hero, so nobody cares. You may find him in my novel, Beyond the Highland Mist, irritating Laird Hawk Douglas. Better him than me. Best wishes, Karen. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Highlander's Touch by Karen Marie Monning. Copyright 2000 by Karen Marie Monning. Read by Phil Giganti. Directed by Laura Grafton. Engineered by Kevin Klimble. Performance copyright 2007 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.